This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Lord of the Rings is usually it spawned epic fantasy.
I like grimdark settings. I'm not the particular fan of grimdark tones.
Erotic fantasy. Book opinions are subjective, but the
everyone else's.
Correct. Let's say you create a dystopian world and you're going, I want to live there. You did it wrong.
Welcome everyone to the Toot Around Podcast. My name is Richard.
My name is Austin.
Today we're talking about fantasy subgenres that you need to know. We're going to be going through Austin here gathered a bunch of the fantasy subgenres that are the most important. We're going to go into detail of the pros, cons, what's important about them, what makes good examples, define it as we are wont to do, probably mispronounce it. As we are more reputable on. So that's the plan.
That is the plan. I think our goal here should be what about the subgenre makes people love it?
Yes.
And then what do people hate about it? Because we're going to have our own opinions on whether it's a good subgenre or not. But I didn't just look at the 26, as you see in the title, subgenres. These are all 26. There's no more. I'm cutting the line because if you get more than 26 subgenres, you're just making stuff up at that point.
You're just making a subgenre of a subgenre or a mixing of two, and that's not fair.
Exactly. And that's not what subgenres are at all.
There's only 26.
Yes.
There exists only 26.
The first one we have, Rich, is low fantasy.
Okay.
Low fantasy as a subgenre. You can guess what the second subgenre we're going to talk about is. But low fantasy is defined as a fantasy book that takes place in our recognizable world. And so it's a fantasy book that takes place in our world, and then you are transported to some magical element in the world. So for example, an example of this would be American Gods. It would also be Percy Jackson and Harry Potter. Now, one of the most well-known one of theirs, Harry Potter, takes place in real Earth, and then there's also this magical Hogwarts place, or Percy Jackson takes place in real Earth. However, Olympian gods are real. American Gods is a book that takes place on real Earth. Yet again, gods are real in these mystical elements. So low fantasy, that's how it's defined. Do you have other examples of low fantasy books that you like, dislike, that you think about?
I mean, the Bible takes place on real Earth.
Off hot. Wow.
I'm kidding. Yeah. I am kidding. I just thought that was funny. Let me know down in the comments how insulted you feel.
So,
but no, there's.
Is that your favorite or least favorite of low fantasy?
That's
you got to dig yourself.
That's my favorite, but then there's plenty of. Technically, if you want to get on technicality, Discworld. Discworld is technically low fantasy.
Is it? The same.
You'll need to read more.
I need to read on. Okay.
I don't think that's a spoiler. It's just fun.
Oh.
That's a fun thing. By technicality, it is. It doesn't read like one, but that's my favorite if I had to pick. I'm just being pedantic.
Okay.
What do you think your favorite low fantasy story is?
Very difficult. I would think off of just the books that we listed, I do really love American Gods. So that's one of my favorite low fantasies. I'll say that because I just can't think of anything else right now off the top of my head.
Off top of your head, I think it does do a little bit of a blending, but it would fall under the definition. Piranesi. Piranesi, I think, would be a low fantasy because it does take place in our world. But we just don't get too much of a focus on it.
Even that could be a little bit of a... That's an interpretation of the book. Some would say it doesn't.
That's true.
So, Piranesi is a wild book where you can walk away from that book. And here's an interesting tidbit. I walked away from Piranesi going, oh, this is one of my... I love this. A top-tier fantasy book. Some people walk away and say it's a sci-fi book and not fantasy whatsoever. And at first I went, that's absurd. You're stupid. And then they explain themselves. Shout out Coop and others from our Patreon. and friend coop. No, just a Patreon.
No, just Patreon coop.
And so then it
actually,
was
he doesn't pay us on Patreon anymore.
No.
I pay him with meals.
But then it was explained to me and there's a defense for it being sci-fi. So again, this whole thing about subgenres and genres are a way of describing books. So when you're going into a bookstore and you want this certain feel, you want, okay, these are the type of books, tropes, genres that you like. They're there to kind of help navigate you for what to expect. They set your expectations, and it's a good way to pitch a book to somebody. And the low fantasy definition that we have of our world, well, I wouldn't put Piranesi necessarily, like say, hey, look at this low fantasy book, which maybe definitively it is you want to go in expecting that you're reading a low fantasy. When you see low fantasy, it's very, you want a very much one-to-one, you're on planet Earth, and it's things you'd recognize, and
it
then
wants to feel. You want it to feel like it is our Earth,
yeah,
with a magical side to it,
yeah,
a hidden, secret magical side that we don't know.
Yes,
us
with the Hogwarts,
us mudbloods.
Exactly. There's a whole wizardly world out there.
Yeah, mudbloods. I was like muggle-bloods. I was trying to, like, again, mispronouncing things as we normally do.
But what do you think are the advantages of a low fantasy book when reading it, and how do you do it well?
Sure. I do want to start off a little differently with the advantages of writing a low fantasy world.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, generally, I would think writing low fantasy is easier than writing high fantasy in the sense of a completely new world. You don't have to create completely new cultures. Like, you can dabble in it, but not everything has to be completely new. You can have landscapes that you can actually look at and see, and you don't have to reimagine the world a little bit. You get to just take the world as it is and then twist it and make it fun. Actually, a recent book I've read that does this pretty well, it is low fantasy, though maybe it borders the line on it, is V.E. Schwab's A Darker Shade of Magic. Because it takes place in our world with London being the central location.
That's a great example of one because, yeah, it is London.
It is.
But then with fantasy London. Elements.
A lot of fantasy elements. Mm-hmm. But still, it is London, apparently. Mm-hmm. But no, beyond that, I think those are the biggest advantages. For the reader, I would say the immediate connection. It's one of those things that it's a little easier to be immersed in. It's not super foreign, so you can picture yourself there. But what do you think are the strong advantages?
That's definitely one of the two big examples that came to mind was Percy Jackson, Harry Potter,
mm-hmm.
of when you're introducing a more maybe middle grade or YA book or something that is, and of course, I also said that example with American Gods, which is an adult fantasy book, and plenty of adult fantasy books can have low fantasy as a subgenre. But it's way easier to introduce fantasy to a newer reader, to a younger reader, of going, hey, look at this Earth you're in, and give this relatable character that's your age. That's step one. Then step two, ooh, now here's the magic. And those type of stories where the main character is so out of the know and doesn't know anything about the magical world, so the character's getting introduced to all the magic as you, the reader, are, rather than just high fantasy throwing you into this new world and having to put the pieces together a little bit.
Because so it wouldn't make as much sense for a character in a high fantasy world to be completely unknown to the wider world that they live in. So their home is not as mysterious as it would be to the reader.
To them, it's normal.
And
right.
I mean, it's one of the advantages of, you know, your farm boy trope is that you have a farm boy, it is his world, but as he gets into the wider world, he is discovering new things about his own world. So that's a way for the reader to learn more without it being completely awkward.
Yes, and that's where I see is a big advantage of low fantasy. And low fantasy is what introduced me to fantasy, if we're thinking way back, of I think some of the first low... Actually, now that I think way, way back, Magic Treehouse, isn't that low fantasy? Right,
yeah,
because you start in your treehouse and then you go into this next other world. That's one of the earliest fantasy book series I read was Magic Treehouse.
Same with me.
It's a great way to introduce children into fantasy, although there's plenty of great low fantasy that is for adults as well. And that's maybe a part of the advantage on the low fantasy for more adult books is it can feel more like literature. Because in the pretentious sense of I kind of get the, you know how fantasy still has this scorn by some of that's not going to ever be your book of the year Pulitzer.
It's just your entertainment. It's not there of any substance.
But if you just have a little bit of fantasy sprinkled into your, maybe it reads more like fiction than fantasy. It toes the line so close that maybe it could be more palatable for people who don't like fantasy and don't like sci-fi. And they'll read this and go, oh, this is close to the literature I typically read. It doesn't dive so far deep into fantasy where someone will get lost. For a not fantasy reader. So I think it does. That's a good advantage of the subgenre.
Is there something about the uncanny valley nature of it? Because I'm going into maybe the cons or the maybe difficulties that low fantasy can offer. To some degree, on the opposite, high fantasy, because it's a completely new world, anything can happen. It can be, if horses actually have no legs and operate like snakes. Instead of horses, we basically ride giant snakes. It's like, sure, of course, why not?
Yeah.
It's just how it is. It's this fantasy world. But with low fantasy, you are working within the boundaries of our world and trying to fit in magical elements and hope and pray that that doesn't break the immersion of our own world. Because if you beat too close against it, people will go, well, that's not how the real world works. Hey, this doesn't make sense because I live here. I know what Earth is like.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if that is, do you think that element is more difficult than creating a whole new fantasy world and allowing the suspension of disbelief? Or do you think it's easier for readers to suspend their disbelief in a low fantasy world?
Boring answer is it depends. But my opinion, sure, my
but
opinionated,
what's your opinionated
answer,
answer?
My opinion answer is, to me, fantasy, the high fantasy, which, do you want to go into high fantasy? Because that's our number two subgenre.
Sure.
So our second subgenre is high fantasy, comparing that to low fantasy. And as you've been describing, all high fantasy is instead
complete
of
secondary world.
Complete secondary world, complete immersion. And to me, this is the type of fantasy that you hear Tolkien and non-fairy stories talking about. And this is the fantasy, the complete immersion, the complete new creation of a secondary world. And this you see in examples, Wheel of Time behind you, The Lord of the Rings, Stormlight Archive, A Song of Ice and Fire. Every big high fantasy story that you hear about, which also is different from epic fantasy, which that's the third one we'll get into, but we'll hold off. So to answer your question, I think the high fantasy worlds are you asking essentially, is it more skillful or difficult to...
Not to write.
Not to write. Okay, you're asking on the reader's end.
On the reader's end, is it easier to get immersed into a low fantasy world or a high fantasy world? What do you think?
Oh, okay.
Because I think an argument of if we just talk about the tendency of low fantasy being linked, tied to adolescent fantasy and young adult fantasy, does that mean that low fantasy is easier for immersion or harder? I'm trying to think about what direction. Do you assume children have an easier time with, or not children, but young adults have an easier time connecting with a fantasy world, so you can use the more difficult genre, more difficult genre of low fantasy, and adults being harder to get immersed, so then you have to use high fantasy because it is easier to immerse someone into it? Or is it vice versa?
Got it. What's easier to get immersed into?
Yeah.
I think generally for a kid, it's easier to get, and I'm saying kid, not even young adult, but children's books or children's fantasy, which you do, again, have your high fantasy children's books or younger. I think, I haven't read Earthsea yet, but I hear Earthsea's for younger audiences, I think, and I think that's just completely high fantasy. But I think for child's imagination, it's also the amount you like as a kid to read something and, oh, is that magical world? Could that be real? You like to insert yourself into that character's situation and think, oh, because this world is just like mine, the Olympian gods could be real. I could be the son of Poseidon or whatever it might be. I think it's probably easier for a kid to get immersed in that because it's introducing the things you know and then getting you into things you don't know and discovering. Whereas the immersion in high fantasy, I think for adults, again, both are valid to read as adults and kids, but for adults in a high fantasy world, maybe we're just more jaded of, we know what the real world's like. So if we're fantasy fans, we kind of want to see something different from the start. And when you think of a book, if you're to think back to the low fantasy books you've read, you'll think maybe less your post-read, and you'll think back to that world of, do you want to escape back to Percy Jackson, or do you want to escape back to the world of the Middle Earth?
Mm.
You know, as an adult.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So what do you think there?
The more you know about the world, the more cracks start to form in the world building of a low fantasy young adult novel, maybe. And so for the high fantasy, you don't have that same problem.
When it's done well, yeah.
When it's done well.
When it's done well, yeah.
Again, that's the caveat through all of these.
Good examples.
As long as it's done well.
I guess, how do you screw that up? Because we were talking about how to do these subgenres well. How do you screw up? You talked about low fantasy, how you screw that up. As soon as I know what the real world's like, if I start to see a crack form, something could be off here. How do you screw up high fantasy?
I mean, it's the same vein, but harder to see because it's completely new. It just has to make internal sense. So as long as you're not breaking your own rules that you kind of established. So if one thing happens, one action happens and consequences happen after that. If it happens again and different consequences happen, you have to go, well, why? Why did that happen? Why did one thing happen here and a different thing happen here? If things don't make sense, then that's a breaking of immersion. It's easier to break immersion maybe with low fantasy because you have background knowledge. But I'm not sure. It also could be you suspend your disbelief more in high fantasy. But I'm not sure. What do you think it is that really breaks it when it's done poorly in high fantasy?
Yeah, breaking your own rules. That's definitely one. I think it's also tough too because sometimes you could just have a cool atmosphere and a cool vibe and go, oh, what a cool world. I just like the feeling this gives me. And a lot of that's because it's written well. I think, that's a part of it is in your high fantasy world, as soon as you start to question what, and if the author doesn't do a good job and you're remembering, oh, there's an author, there's a person writing this. And when you are broken from that immersion, that's when it fails. There's 1,000 ways to actually break your immersion. But the books we remember and think back to for how cool this world is, how intricate it is, Song of Ice and Fire, Lord of the Rings, some of the big high fantasy worlds people would know, those, the deeper it feels for those kind of stories, the better the high fantasy is because it's a well. It just keeps going and going. And you always feel, high fantasy mixes these two things of one, you want to feel immersed and that you're in the world, but two, you want to feel as though there's a lot of things you don't know and still want to discover. Because if you end and all the questions are gone, well, there you go. You answered everything. The fantasy's over. But I want a high fantasy book when I'm reading it to every time it introduces and I feel like I understand more, I'm asking questions too. So if you're ever in a high fantasy book answering everything, for me, if you answer everything, the curiosity's gone. I'm like, okay, it's not my favorite. So I want curiosity as well in my high fantasy.
I think I'm starting, correct me if I'm wrong, at least this
you
is
are.
My kind of, yeah, of course. This is the direction I'm thinking of it.
Yeah.
High fantasy, the goal is to make it to not break immersion, is to make it as different from our own world. Because the closer you start seeing elements of our real world into it, the more you feel the author's presence. If it is a completely new fantasy world, but clearly one group of people is just the Irish and like very much just is the Irish people and that's all it is. And there's no like twist on it, but it's too similar. It takes you out of it of going like, oh, it's closer to our real world. And it could maybe break immersion. And you feel the author's hand in it.
Especially if you're expecting the high fantasy. Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Versus low fantasy. Maybe you want to stick a little closer to the real world of it and to remind you that this is our world. Because then if it steps too far into the fantastical elements of the story, you go, wait, but this is our world. How does these things mix? And so you always want to remind the reader that, hey, look, this is our world too. It just has this secret element to it.
Especially if you make a world that's so different, the cultures are so different, and everything, which is a part of immersion, an immersion-breaking thing to do in a high... A lot of television shows and adaptations ruin this for books and for worlds, like Rings of Power and other types of shows.
Oh, yeah.
Where the way to break immersion is go, wait a second, so you have these understandings of whether it's Middle Earth or any other fantasy book. And then when you input things that feel as if it's speaking to a modern audience, or it's using a modern analogy, or it's doing something
that
breaks immersion, because it doesn't feel like this world would do it. It feels like writers who are writing about this world that have opinions would portray it like this.
Yeah.
And
using the modern idioms, turns of phrase, just kind of break it. I know the biggest immersion breaking moment for me in TV that I remember is Rings of Power, like you mentioned, of being told literally over narration of the Harfoots being this nomadic tribe of pseudo hobbits, and they quite literally have this incredible ability to completely hide their village when any outsider is like shown to be near.
Which episode was this, by the way? Because I only watched two of them.
Episode one.
Oh, okay.
We're good.
So I saw that one, yes.
Yeah, okay. We both saw that one. Okay, that was good.
No, sorry.
And so completely nomadic, isolated tribe of hobbits. And they were as colorful as the rainbow. Like, every shade of melanin in there. They spoke with different accents. And then, like, you go, this is the father, mother, and the daughter. And you go, like, one, the daughter is speaking with a different accent than the mother and the father. And all three of them have different skin complexions. And you just start going to yourself, like, that doesn't... For a nomadic, like, isolated tribe that, like, hides itself from all outsiders, how does that work?
And then it's immersion breaking. You're going, wait, how would this work? And now you're thinking, okay, and I'm no longer thinking about the world you're trying to immerse me in. I'm now thinking about
I'll be honest, real world. The color one, like, that's the visual one of, like, hey, how is this nomadic tribe, like, all these different races? That doesn't make sense in this world. That, I can almost understand, like, hey, it's Hollywood movie magic. What, like, we just had a bunch of actors. Maybe it's a little lazy to just pick the actors. What I found more insulting is the different accents. You couldn't bother just some writer going, all right, they're all British. They are going to sound British. Make a fake British accent. That's what they all are going to sound like now. Fine. And, like, some consistency. Mm-hmm. But no, they're just like, one's Irish, one's just clearly American. And it's like, why try? They put in an ounce of effort into immersion.
But that's the point about, insulted me. Again, high fantasy world, breaking that immersion is going, okay, you're no longer thinking in the realms of what this world would do, how it would function.
Yeah.
And then you're taking liberties, or you're doing something. That's one example. But the Wheel
of Time did the other one.
In shows, yeah.
God. Where that was actually plot relevant of the important factor is one of our main characters looks very different from everyone else in the village. That's an important plot point. And then when we get the show, it's like everyone's just a mix. And it's like, why would our main character stand out? Why would anyone notice him different? Because everyone else is different. It doesn't.
Oh, Rand. Yes. With the red hair.
Yes. That's an important plot point. Yes. And they just.
You know, you've brought up Wheel of Time a couple times. I haven't made fun of it yet. If you do it once more this episode, I'm throwing shots.
You can try.
I will.
It just speaks to your ignorance. It makes me feel pity for you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Bilbo. Okay. So, yes, that immersion breaking with high fantasy, I think that's when it's done wrong. Of you're starting to question the logic of things. You're starting to feel the author's hand in it as well. And there's plenty of modern fantasy books that, again, do, like, where the cultures do make sense in that way. And that's why plenty of your sci-fi as well, when you read sci-fi, the world building is so much more different, because it's often fantasy is looking at less developed or more ancient technology, and sci-fi is looking forward. So that just inherently changes the focus of the world building as well. Not that, again, there's another one that we have here. We have epic fantasy next, then sci fantasy is our fourth. So we're going to start getting into some gray areas of what's actually fantasy or sci-fi. But do you want to go into our third one?
Epic fantasy.
Epic.
Epic fantasy.
That's a bold statement.
How would you define epic fantasy as a subgenre?
Often you'll hear, so why I want to do these three first of low, high, and epic. High and epic fantasy, you'll hear bunched up into one because they overlap all the time. The ones that were just said of Lord of the Rings, Wheel of Time, Song of Ice and Fire, all three of those are all high fantasy and all epic fantasy. Because epic fantasy is more described as your grand scale, wide scope, worlds at stake. They are your tomes. They are looking at the macro world. The world is the focus rather than your not epic fantasy would be some of your Discworld books you just mentioned.
I would say Locke Lamora.
Yes, Locke Lamora is a great example where it's high fantasy because it's a completely different world, except the book Locke Lamora focuses on just this thief and his issues. It's not focused on, as the definition I looked up online says, there's grand scale, world-threatening conflict, and focus on large, often multi-point of view narratives. That's your epic fantasy, which we love our epic fantasy.
Does it require the multi-point of view?
It says often. It doesn't require, but often does just because the more epic and feel, usually you'll get different spots in the world. Mm-hmm. So what do you think on the epic fantasy scale of these are some of your favorite books, our favorite books? How do you do that well, and how do you screw it up?
Well, how do you do it well? I mean, the feeling that you should get is when you're reading an epic fantasy, you want every POV. So if we're focusing on the multi-POV section, if you're finding that one or multiple POVs are just there for plot details, but ultimately you're reading it just to get to the other character, that's definitely a way to do it poorly. Normally, that's definitely a hard aspect. You have to have an engaging character, but you have to have multiple of them, and you have less time to do it because you're sharing the time or page count with everyone. But other than that, I think there's a hard thing for connection with epic fantasy, because very often the end of the world is not it's not really a personal draw. So you have to both make a compelling end of the world threat and make it, you know, the bombastic. You have to make that exciting in the sense of like cinematic. I would say like the end of the world threat is a cinematic enjoyment. But then add on top of that the, like, throughput of what personal connection does the main characters have in this plot. And it will not be, oh, they want to, you know, save the world. So it's normally something else.
Yeah. Your big daddy of Lord of the Rings is usually it spawned epic fantasy as we know it. This is where a lot... I mean, it inspired the whole fantasy genre, but even specifically epic fantasy. People hadn't read that before.
Well, you can easily boil down of Lord of the Rings is epic fantasy because the world is at stake, but ultimately the through line for all of our main characters is a story. Like, the reason why all of our characters care about this is because of the friendship that they have.
Yeah.
And the close friendship that the Fellowship has is the primary motivation on most of their actions. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why Aragorn, says for Frodo, not for Gondor, not for anything else. It's for Frodo. Same thing with Samwise and Frodo. They're going to destroy the ring, and they're there to save the world, but it's also for their friends and for each other.
And is that how you could screw it up if you lose that in epic fantasy?
I think so. That is definitely a problem I've seen with other epic fantasies of too much of a focus on the epic nature of it, the end of the world event. And ultimately, that's not really why we care.
You care about the end of the world because you care about the characters that live in that world.
Yeah.
Otherwise, end of the world. Sci-fi can get away with that more sometimes.
I think
that's for our sci-fi subgenre episode, though. Okay, that's epic fantasy. Our fourth one, Rich, you want to take this one away? Number four.
I will take it. Yes. Sure. Sci-fantasy.
Oh, yeah.
Genre that blends science fiction and fantasy together. Notable authors in the genre is not necessarily like the biggest, but one of the bigger names that he's trying to go into it.
Yeah.
Brandon Sanderson, I think, is pretty well known of. He's been building up his Cosmere universe to move everything in the direction of sci fantasy. That's his big aim and goal, and to turn fantasy into sci fantasy, which is a really cool effort, because often you'll have different genres of where it is either fantasy, sci-fi, or sci fantasy,
yeah,
whatever it is. But you don't often see that evolution. which is really fun to see.
Yeah, you see throughout his Mistborn eras and Stormlight, which will be, that it starts fantasy. It starts purely fantasy. Then even as the magic's explored, you start to figure out, okay, there's more science elements to this. The definition says it's a genre that blends elements both science fiction and fantasy, often featuring a world that appears fantastical, but with explanations rooted in scientific principles. Now, a couple of examples you'll hear when people say, well, this is a science fiction book that has fantasy elements or vice versa. You'll hear Dune often come up, where Dune is very sci-fi. You look at Dune, it's sci-fi. Yeah. You think sci-fi first, but then you ask questions about the prophecy elements, the Bene Gesserit, and some of the magic of it.
Yeah, it does start going into the psychedelic level where you go, all right, is that really science at this point? And all the stuff that Kwisatz Haderach can actually do leans a lot more toward fantasy than sci-fi.
The mind and tongues, and even that in the first place, is a bit more...
Yeah, yeah. The voice.
The voice, yes. And another big one is Star Wars. Science, everybody will say science fiction, you see it science fiction, but then you look at the Force. What's the Force? It's magic. It's more fantasy elements. Now, of course,
before the prequels, it was more sci fantasy, because it had that more fantastical element.
Yep.
And then as the prequels and then the sequels and everything else, it probably turns a little bit more
midichlorians and
where it gets more sci-fi itself. Even if it's bad sci-fi, it's still trying to explain the fantastical in some scientific manner.
Yeah.
Even if it does it poorly.
The Book of the New Sun is also
Do you define that one?
Say sci-fantasy for that?
God, what is that book?
I think sci-fantasy.
I guess so.
Right?
Like, there's so many different elements of it where it looks like fantasy, but it's actually sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And then other elements that look like sci-fi and it's actually fantasy.
Like, that's why I think it fits. Yeah.
There were so many different, I remember thinking to myself, this is just that a fantastical element, like these weird creatures, and going, oh, it's actually based on this, like a real life principle. It's like more of a robot type of deal, not a gigantic man. But then there's other elements where I think I was going like, okay, is this a euphemism for something else? Is this a weird term for something we already know about? I'm like, nope, it's just a fantasy element. It's just a razor sharp flower.
Poink.
It's just a razor sharp sword flower that people fight with, and it's a super thing, poisonous. And I'm going, is this related to anything in our world? Nope. It just is. It's a fantasy thing, and we just had to live with it. It's confusing.
I'm excited for book two.
I am too.
We got to get back together. Claw the Conciliator. Yes. That is your sci fantasy. Blends both. Often when people think sci-fi or fantasy too, I think my mind at least does this. I think setting. Where's the setting? So when I think Star Wars or Dune, my first thought is sci-fi. Yeah. Just because you associate, okay, what's the setting you're in when you say, hey, this is a Western book or this is whatever. Often you'll define things by the setting. And science fiction has a setting to it that you automatically get. And then where it starts to blend. So Red Rising, for example, is very much sci-fi setting to the extreme. But you'll hear sci-fantasy a lot when Red Rising is brought up. Why do you think people bring up fantasy when it comes to it? Clearly, Red Rising is science fiction. But
I would say
sci-fantasy.
I think it's just because it doesn't focus too hard on the tech of it. Often, if you want to say like it's a hard sci-fi, it has this deep focus on how the science fiction elements work.
Yeah.
And Red Rising doesn't. It just has grav boots. What do? They make you fly or float. How? They just do. That's sci-fi things. It works a lot more similarly to, Star Wars in the sense of like lightsabers. They're just your laser swords.
It's a razor
blade. It's a razor. What is it? So I wouldn't say it's fair to call Red Rising sci fantasy. It just is a sci-fi book that doesn't focus too much on
hard sci-fi elements. Totally.
But what do you think is the advantage of sci fantasy? What do you think it does better than other genres?
Sci fantasy if somebody doesn't like hard sci-fi, they don't want to get into the weeds of how does all this work. Mm-hmm. Fantasy is a way of giving you a soft magic or soft explanation of, okay, this is, you don't have to know the answer to how the Force works. Fans often didn't want to know midichlorians existed. It was a lot cooler when the Force was the Force.
Yeah.
So the advantage is, if you don't want your hard sci-fi, which a hard sci-fi would be Project Hail Mary, for example.
Yep.
That's hard.
That's hard sci-fi.
That is hard. And
more so The Martian, but it's still, yeah, it's hard sci-fi.
They're hard sci-fis. And then you have, automatically when you're a reader and you don't want all the explanations, you don't want that in your books. So sci-fantasy gives you the setting of a science fiction book. It gives you the setting of all cool future stuff. However, the explanations are immersion of a fantasy where you don't have to dive into the science explanations of it. So when people are reading Red Rising, you go into Red Rising with, oh, cool, science fiction setting, but I know I'm not going in here. I guess when people also say it's sci-fantasy, it's because it has these characters that are focused on, and it feels often like those epic fantasies you read, or space opera would be the other term, but mm-hmm. it feels like these fantasy stories, which fantasy is typically associated with being more character focused, typically, but again, it goes both ways. So when you're reading a Red Rising or a Dune, your Star Wars, and it's science fiction, but you also get some of the benefits that the fantasy genre offers, that's where the benefit is. And if you're looking for that, especially.
What about the other way around of a fantasy setting, but sci-fi-ish feel of the story?
Oh, what's an example?
That's what we're talking about. Okay. Stormlight. So the Cosmere itself is more of a fantasy setting with a heavier focus on treating the magic like a science. And as it develops even further and further on, the world itself is becoming a little bit more sci-fi-esque.
Yes. Yeah.
Are there any other examples you could think of?
Mistborn. All Sanderson stuff, though.
Yeah.
It's all Sanderson stuff. He's doing... That's kind of unique. From what we've read. I think you're right, though, to say...
Powder Mage, I guess, could go in that direction.
Okay.
I mean, it is just... It is fantasy, but there is a focus on the hard magic system and how it develops over time.
I got one, I think. I was looking at the bookshelf. I don't know if this will be the case. Also, no spoilers, it's a newer book. But The Will of the Many is a fantasy book. But I could see, if you've read the book
It could be.
It could be. We have the book two's not out yet. So it could go in that direction where it's totally fantasy setting. But there's a lot to the world building where I'm going, is this just fantasy? I don't know yet. We'll see.
It could be.
And that's where maybe Pure Nessie is one of those things where Pure Nessie is fantasy book, but could also be argued to be
That's probably the better genre to put it in, is sci-fantasy. In very many ways, of it depends on your interpretation, but it does have so many different elements of both that it's hard to delineate between the two. It would be more of a... It's more of a fantasy... So, through one POV, it's, you know, through one character, it's a fantasy setting, and through another character, it's a sci-fi setting.
Yeah.
Which is fun. Yeah, that's all it is a perspective change. Mm. But okay.
That's our sci-fantasy. We now got our next two here are YA fantasy, young adult fantasy, and middle grade fantasy.
Don't die.
Okay. So YA fantasy, your young adult versus middle grade fantasy. YA fantasy is aimed at 12 to 18 range. Middle grade is aimed more at your middle grade, so your younger audiences. And your YA would be a book such as Aragon.
Mm-hmm.
And middle grade would be your Narnia, Percy Jackson, Harry Potter age. These books aged into YA, but started middle grade as well, especially. Now, I wanted to include these two here for the YA middle grade, just because you're just writing to that target audience. There's the good way to do it is, hey, you're successfully reaching that target age.
It very often is probably the wide net of it is what is the main character's age. And then that basically defines what genre it's put in. That's not always the most accurate. So, like, The Poppy War could be confused with being a YA book just because of the main character's age. I would not make that a YA book.
Right.
That is not appropriate for many younger people. I would not give that book to a lot of young adults.
Mistborn has a young protagonist, Vin, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily YA. It's more adult. It's ish, yeah.
It's more so YA than Poppy War, but yes.
Yeah.
You may want to read it. I don't know. You may hate it, just like me, but I don't know.
Oh, you hate it. You hate it. I gotta read it.
I've hated it with more time.
Okay.
The more time I sit with it, the more I dislike it. It's one of those things of R.F. Kuang is a good writer, and I like the writing of the book. The book is actually really well written. Mm-hmm. Dialogue, like, it is well done. But I really don't like the main characters or, like, the direction of the story. The direction of the story is vastly uninteresting to me, and it made me hate it more over time with my thoughts. And then also, I just really don't like the main character.
But it's not YA, though. It's
adult. Oh, no. Okay. No, definitely not. Definitely not.
That's one way to screw up YAs of you. The age of the character is important. So that usually the rule of thumb I've heard is if you make your character 16 or whatever it is, again, exceptions, Mistborn, Poppy Board, etc. But if you make your character 16, you're trying to reach somebody that's 2 years younger. So 14, or if your character's 18, you're trying to reach someone 16 and older. That obviously, and someone who's 16, but that age range of, again, your middle grade books will have a 12-year-old protagonist. I think Percy's 12 in the first book. So you're reaching 10, 11, 12-year-olds and some 13-year-olds. And our friend Justin, who still reads Percy Jackson every night in bed to himself. That's his thing.
How many times has he read all the way through the Percy Jackson series?
An amount of time where I'd either be extremely jealous or extremely concerned for his mental health, depending on which way you want to take it.
I'm pretty sure he's on like his fourth or fifth read through.
This year, probably.
Yeah.
He's read it a lot. Yeah.
He's read it a lot.
I'm here for that. You know, if you like your thing.
I'm not. I'm so happy we've been getting him to read other things. It's been. So far, we've picked banger books.
See, if you go talk to Justin, though, and you see the emptiness in his heart.
It's because he's missing his Percy Jackson.
Yeah, sometimes you just need him to get the fixation and then give him. It's a 1-2. Don't read two self-help books in a row, you'd say. Don't read two Percys in a row. Read Percy book one, then go try Three Body Problem. Then go back into Percy book two so that maybe you can appreciate Percy more and go, hey, I don't like all this adult complex stuff. Give me, I'm a 27-year-old adult who wants to read about an infant child and their struggle. Actually, I still think it's kick-ass, so I shouldn't make too fun of him, but.
You know what I tried getting him to read as a joke?
What?
I gave him A Fire Upon the Deep.
I don't think he would like that.
That was a joke recommendation to him. I just wanted to see how far he'd get. He's like, Richard, what is this story? Why'd you give me this one?
It's so good.
I know. But also, I get it.
It's a certain reader.
There's a time in my life, most of the time of my life, if you handed me that book, I would have not finished it. Like, too much.
That was for our book club read, which, by the way, if you want to join our book club, our Patreon in the link in the description below, we do a book club every month. And Fire Upon the Deep was one of them. Would not have read it otherwise if it wasn't for the book club picking it. And even while I was reading it, I was going, yeah, I don't know if this is for me. And then the longer I've gone since reading that book, it just sticks with you.
It does.
It's a glue of a book where I haven't read anything like it ever since. Yeah, it's good. It's real good.
I do can't wait to like make sure that we clip out us roasting our friend Justin and then sending him just that clip.
Yes.
We'll be time set. Hi, Justin. Also, if you want to see more of Justin, he's in a previous episode.
Yeah.
He's in our episode of
Project Hail Mary.
Yes. He was in others, but we had to delete those episodes.
Why did we delete them, you ask? He reads Percy Jackson. He doesn't have much of an attention span. He was clicking pens.
In the mic.
The audio was screwed. It was so bad. It was real bad. And I was not a good enough editor like Nick is now to erase all those clicks. But it's almost like he was trying. He took it and was like... right in front of them. It was something else. So that's our YA middle grade is for your Justins out there.
And for your Justins, yep.
So if you're an adult child or if you are that target range, Pendragon's another good example of one of middle grade. And so that it's just trying to reach that audience. I think obviously these are more obvious of genres of how you do it wrong is introduced to adult or complex themes to your target audience of a middle grade, or you really want to guide your, let's talk middle grade for a second. You want to guide your middle grade reader. Often could be a low fantasy world, as we were talking about at the beginning of this episode. You want to guide them, try to give them somebody that is somewhat relatable to them, maybe a self-insert, or at least somebody that you can explore the world through and root for. That's generally what you see with these books. Mm-hmm. And you are discovering the world with them. You're discovering magic. And it's often, the themes of the book are often, hey, friendship and fellowship or some coming of age theme of problems that a middle grade or young adult could associate with.
Family learning that issues. Perseverance is a superpower in and of its own.
Yes. Friendship's a power until you get old, kids. And you learn it sticks you in a podcast room and it's.
Yeah. Until you're stuck together.
Yeah. Whoa. Now, an opposite subgenre here. So now we're getting into dystopian and post-apocalyptic.
I don't know if it's that separated. I mean, I think our childhoods was defined by middle grade dystopian novels.
And YA, but Hunger Games, Maze Runner, Divergent. Actually, yeah.
Pendragon-ish.
Is that?
Kinda.
I'm forgetting a lot of the plot. It's been a long time.
It's portal fantasy, but like the portals go to dystopian YA novel places. It's like multiple YA dystopian settings in one series.
So there's some examples of one. Pendragon is one of them. This is your, I'll quote the definition. It often features elements of magic, adventure, fantastical creatures, but with a focus on themes appropriate for that age group. I was reading the middle grade stuff. Dystopian is, yeah?
Yeah, no, you just copied the wrong one.
I copied the wrong thing, yes. So dystopian is not that. Dystopian is when you are, Hunger Games is a great example, you are in a world that survival is important, and it's a very grim, there's an oppressive government typically, or oppressive society, and there's a gritty kind of feel to it.
I don't think it really can be a dystopian post-apocalyptic fantasy without the main character, one of their primary goals of the story is survival.
Yeah.
That's a core element of it. Is survival either for themselves or their family. And then you kind of have to throw in there generally an oppression of some type, either the government or people or some. It's normally the government, let's be honest.
It's government, it's a corporation, it's those two. You're pickings.
Pick one. Are you a libertarian or are you liberal? That's basically, those are the only two different people that write these books.
Pick your enemy.
It's the only two.
Do you want Jeff Bezos as enemy or do you want fascist regime as your enemy? Or what could be a third option? There's got to be a third option.
Bald man or mustache man? Those are, you pick your path.
You've described, that's not just dystopia. That's every book ever.
That's all.
You've described all villains. Name one that's not that.
Yeah, no, I can't think of it.
And if you do in the comments, you're wrong.
You're wrong. It's all those two. There's only two evil hairstyles. Apparently.
If you are both bald and have just a mustache. Watch out.
Oh, yeah.
Holy crap.
Oh, that's the villain of
villains
right
there. You're about to get money laundered and a genocide at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Whoa. Okay. So your dystopian, that's your dystopian, and it often has a setting of just a gritty feel. Survival, that's a key element of it.
This is a fantasy dystopian, not your 1984s type of deal.
How would you do a successful fantasy dystopian? And, well, we talked about that, be it survival, et cetera. How would you get it wrong? What are these books, a bad dystopian, what would it look like?
Personally, I mean, it's kind of hard to mess them up in all honesty. I think most of them are just pretty easy going. It's when you lack that threat of personal safety. If the main character is surviving this world a little too easily and it's kind of going through the motions of like the author tells you there's this big threat, and ultimately our main character is just kind of going through the motions and is accomplishing tasks too easily. That's probably the hardest thing. There's also the element of, you start thinking to yourself, like, how the hell did this fascist or corporate oppressive government or whatever have you, what powers that be, how the hell did they stay in power? They're so incompetent or so, like, so cruel. You go, like, the story is telling you, oh, yeah, this corporation has been in power for seven generations, like, you know, or 300 years or 500,000 years. And you go, how? They would have killed everybody by now. Like, that doesn't make sense how they're still around.
The Harkonnens in the Dune movies.
Yes.
They are just so evil. I'm going, they're not like, okay, I'm being a book person and going, they're not like that in the book. I get it. It's an adaptation. I get it.
But you also just go, like, but at a certain
just
point,
cutting everybody's head off. Just
if you slice the throat
of every, out of line.
If you slice the throat of every servant that tells you slightly negative news, you'll end up with being Putin. Oh, maybe that's too political. Oh. I am American. It's fine. It's fine. It's whatever.
Yeah.
Putin has problems of...
Rose is your name, but when you poop, it sure don't smell like roses. You're number two, burns the hair in my nose. But we fought hand in paw, now your poop don't stink at all. Now that the air is clear, I'll treasure your front and rear, my sweet rose.
Instantly neutralize poop stink with Poop Fighter from World's Best Cat Litter for the world's best cat.
You know, having loyal.
Well, he has bigger problems than you. Is that, you're not his number one enemy? Oh, okay.
He does have bigger problems than me.
Now, that whole tangent we're getting on about dystopian then, what gets it wrong? What are we saying gets the dystopian wrong? You're just saying if you screw up the threat, if you screw up, it's, you're not feeling the survivalness. You're not feeling that this is an actual...
I think so. It's that element, but maybe it also does come down to the personal element. Why else is our main character fighting? A big reason why Katniss Everdeen from Hunger Games works so well is not that she's trying to survive for herself. That's a part of it. But the genesis of her fighting in the games is protecting her sister. And so it's fighting for others. And so it's that hero moment. Mm-hmm. But how do you think so? What doesn't work for you?
I think the number one way of screwing up dystopian is if it's utopian.
Name an example, please. I need help. What do you mean?
I'm just being cheeky. I'm being like, if it's a utopian world, then it's not. You screw up dystopian.
That's how you do it. Okay.
Like, let's say you create a dystopian world and you're going, I want to live there. You did it wrong. If you're going, man, you should not want to live in the world of Hunger Games. However, a lot of people go, oh, what? What district am I? Which, actually, that's maybe a feature, too, of, I'm noticing in the Divergent Hunger Games, which aren't necessarily like these fantasy books. So I'm just using those as, sorry, I know we're doing fantasy subgenres, but using outside examples, just fiction examples. But some of the features of that and of fantasy is picking a team, picking, oh, am I this or this or this, which also helps with your YA of, hey, would you be a Divergent? Would you be a Dauntless? Or would you be a...
Would I be an Adonis? I hope so.
Dauntless.
Oh, what is that from?
From Divergent.
I didn't read Divergent.
I did.
I skipped that one.
Yeah.
I think I tried Maze Runner. I don't think I finished all of that.
Divergent factions. I finished that too. I was very into that stuff. Abnegation. That was it. Amity, Cador, Dauntless, and Erudite. Yeah, okay. That brings me back. Wow, that really brings me back. This was a fun conversation with myself on that, because you have no idea what I'm...
I got Hunger Games, and I technically read Maze Runner.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything other than there was a maze in the beginning.
I gotta say, Maze Runner hooked me so hard as a kid. I could still remember being in bed, and I was in that YA dystopian phase of... First off, the mystery of where the hell are they? Why is there this maze they have to get out of? The mystery of book one is awesome. As soon as you find out stuff, which I won't reveal, but then you're going, oh, okay, it's this book. But the mystery was so cool, and I still remember, this is early on in the book, if you don't, it's like chapter maybe five, whatever it is, but you get this main character who wakes up, and they don't know where they are. They're being, I forget what he's called, but he can not even remember his name, or just barely remembers
his
name.
Amnesia.
Yeah.
That's the term.
Thank you. That's it.
You were looking for.
Fuck. He has amnesia. I think he remembers just his name. I can't remember, though, how amnesia'd he is. Mm. Gets introduced to this gang, a gang of these boys. They've got a boys' club going around trying to get out of the maze. And then all of a sudden, act one, the end of act one, wherever this happens, for the first time with all these hundreds or dozens of guys who have been surviving here for years, a girl appears.
Oh.
A girl is now in the maze.
Scandalous.
And as a testosterone developing boy, I was going, oh my God, is our main character, ooh, like, oh, he's so gonna get the girl, bro. And then,
does he?
No spoilers.
Come on, I don't care. No one cares.
They all care. Ugh. What, are you actually asking?
No, I know the answer
you know
to the question.
Answer. Yeah, yeah.
I don't even remember the book, but I know the answer to that question.
But I was so hooked. Oh, I was hooked. Because how does this change the whole dynamic? Oh my goodness, why? Oh, the question of why is there now a girl? Why has it all been guys this whole time? And then after our amnesia'd filled, what did they call them when they were first-timers? Goonies or whatever, I forget. But then...
That's real close to a different curse word.
Oh, oh shit. But I forgot what they called them. It's something with a G. But anyways, then you get this and
I didn't know they were all Italian.
They're all guineas. That's all. And so then you have girl pop up and you're going, what the hell? Oh, it was so fascinating. And anyway, so the dystopian era, I'm curious if there's anybody that's reads YA books right now, if you're in that age range of, is that a thing that was just our generation? A lot of dystopians came out and we read those, or is that a thing every single generation goes through? Every generation is loving their YA, their dystopian books. Is that a kind of phase people go through? I'm curious. Let us know.
So.
Let us know your experience.
Now,
in the
we've been talking a lot about the YA element of it, but yes. What about just
adult stuff.
Adult dystopian?
You're right.
All that stuff.
You're right. Yes.
What do you think? Is there any difference?
What's a good example of that?
There's one book that I haven't read that I've been wanting to read for a while now. Actually, for like over 3 years, I bought it. I have it on the shelf here. The Fifth Season by N.K. Jessamyn. It is
fantasy-esque.
But it is, like, honestly, it's the right category to put it in would be sci-fantasy post-apocalyptic dystopian.
Oh, neat.
That would be the order of events. So I've been wanting to read that one, but I don't think we've read too many fantasy dystopian novels.
Not adult ones, no.
No.
All the ones that I would have read would be younger.
Dystopian, I would say the book that I'm reading right now maybe dances close to it in its themes on, like, oppressive regimes and kind of stuff would be By Blood by Salt. But also another one would be, it's a book we recently read by ML Wang. Help me out. What's the name of the book?
Oh, Blood Over Brighthaven?
Blood Over Brighthaven, yeah. I think would qualify for that as well.
Okay.
Very much a dystopian, it's a dystopian novel, not post-apocalyptic.
Okay. That would be more academia, but I see what you mean. Dark academia. Eh. Dark academia, maybe?
I mean, it's a blending.
Yeah,
but
it could be blending. I was just looking up to get some ideas from Google here. One that comes up, this is still maybe younger. I read it in eighth grade for class, but The Giver. Remember The Giver?
Yeah.
That's possibly another one. And that's a good example.
Also, The Giving Tree.
There you go. I didn't read that.
That'll make you cry.
Oh.
That's a book that is... It's supposed to be for young people, and it's designed to make them cry. You haven't read The Giving Tree?
Let me see. The Giving Tree.
How have you not?
The Giving Tree.
What?
Oh, that's too long of a book for me.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
That's
that my TBR is a little packed.
A little longer than Red Rising.
Yeah. Also, I'm looking at the cover now. I'm sure I've read The Giving Tree. I just don't remember it. But I do remember seeing this. Like, see that picture right there? I know that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's iconic. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you don't remember this book. That's like the childhood trauma book. Do you not? Man.
Don't talk about my divorced parents on camera one more time. I shoved that down as a child. Hey, guess who didn't give to me? My parent.
Clearly, you didn't have a giving tree in your life.
If I understood that reference, I'd be so mad.
I am making a divorce joke. It's okay.
The next one. This is our eighth subgenre, is paranormal horror fantasy. Paranormal horror fantasy is a subgenre that blends fantasy elements with paranormal phenomena often set in the real world with supernatural beings or events. This is a lot of Stephen King's.
Yeah.
Stephen
King, basically It or The Shining. I would say for things that I've read, is The Black Tongue Thief. It dances around it. It's a book that is by a standard horror author. And so it is a fantasy story, but the setting, kind of the elements, you could definitely tell he's a horror writer. And then most recently for this year, probably in the running for our 2025 best book of the year, we'll see how the rest of the year goes, but Discovery by J.J. Mitten.
Yes.
Is your horror...
Amazing.
Or cosmic horror fantasy book.
That and Annihilation are these horror paranormal books that are so amazing. I think this paranormal horror fantasy, the way to do it right is create an atmosphere. It's often a lot of times you don't even need to have a character that you're super invested in or rooting for, but just are you able to set an atmosphere that gives an actual emotional reaction to the reader. It's if you watch a horror movie, not just the jump scares, but you're watching it kind of on the edge of your seat going, oh, it plays with the human emotions in a way that provokes you and provokes your fear response. That's a way to do these right. Or provokes your, a mystery doesn't necessarily have to jump scare you, like I just said, but it provokes a mystery that has you on edge. You are on alert, and it's could just be pure curiosity mystery, which Discovery is not necessarily a scary book. It's fascinating, yeah, curious, and it gives you that more paranormal than horrifying.
Sure.
If that's the correct way to use those words. But how do you think?
Yeah.
I think that's the key element to them. More atmosphere. Do you agree with that? And what else can a paranormal horror do that get somebody to like the book?
Well, I mean, the difference between a standard horror book and a horror fantasy is definitely the more mystical elements. I think it leans more into the mystery and the unknown. So that's why Stephen King, a lot of it's still set in a story that is set in our world and has a horror element, but there's definitely an element of the fantastical to it. There is this grander world. There's something mysterious, mystical around it all. And I think that's what does lean it more into fantasy, and especially how it connects to different other worlds and wibbly wobbly.
Wibbly wobbly is actually the perfect way to say it.
Yeah.
Paranormal's wibbly wobbly.
Yeah, there we go.
And the wrong way to do it, if you're not scary. If you're not being paranormal enough.
So would Discovery fail at this then? Because it's not particularly scary.
I was just kind of being facetious. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'll go more serious. Okay. So this, I'll be more serious as our next one is absurdist, comedic, and your surreal. So your comedy absurdist fantasy, well known of these ones being Discworld.
Discworld, not Hitchhikers, because that's sci-fi, yes. But Discworld would be your top.
Alice's Wonderland.
Yep. Then you have a more recent book that we've read, Orconomics, would be a little bit more...
Comedic.
It's comedic. Not yes. A little absurd, somewhat.
Yeah. No, it doesn't have to be too absurd. Other comedy ones would be Kings of the Wild. Or
yep.
Just comedy. Comedy fantasy.
a fantasy story that doesn't take itself too seriously and adds a bunch of humor into it.
Yes.
That's basically it. What is, now, I would say, I'm going to start off right with the negative of, I think the harder thing to write with a comedic fantasy story is the comedy can often come at the cost of world building and will get in the way of immersion. Do you ever notice that?
In everyone except Discworld, yes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what makes Discworld magical, is like you can have an absurdist comedic world and comedic story, and yet the world is still immersive. I still haven't run into a better example than that, because every other comedic fantasy story, I may be able to laugh, but it will come at the cost a little bit at the world building.
Yeah, I think obviously comedy is so subjective. Book opinions are subjective. But the
everyone else's.
Correct. Yeah. You're talking about, hey, does that happen in books where the comedy breaks the world immersion for you? It can often, because sometimes jokes can feel modern or take you out in that way, if not even necessarily breaking the world. But for example, Nicholas Eames, we had on the channel, and Kings of the Wild is above average book. Yeah, it is also more for people who get the references of it is a 80s bands punk rock, or sorry, not punk rock, but just classic rock combined with D&D, and it hits that audience perfectly. So there's one joke in there that essentially reminded me of the Disney Channel, like, he's right behind me, isn't he, you know, something like that.
Yeah,
that sometimes the comedy can take you out just going, oh, okay, that's a joke that you'd use in the modern sense, or it could seem overused. And
well, that's I think that's ultimately the biggest problem, is comedy often relies on references, idioms, turns of phrase that only work in our modern world and ultimately jar against the fantasy setting. Mm-hmm. And so the easier way to do comedy in a fantasy story is situational comedy, because that can actually be just totally immersed.
I'm so glad you said that.
And yeah, it's the reason why Joe Abercrombie tends to be just so funny. Most of his humor is either situational or the character's sarcastic lines. And so kind of the character's thought process of a situation.
Yeah.
Which works really well.
Is comedy, how would you see comedy as a tool? Or do you think it's very hard to pull off as an author?
Yeah.
Extremely. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. The book I'm writing is comedic. It's absurd elements, but also I'm trying to be funny with it. And it's also very, because when you're writing a book, I could see from the author's end of attempting.
I feel so bad for the readers.
Me too.
That's going to be so cringe.
But here's the thing. If they cringe, I'll be like, you know what? Author's intent doesn't matter. you cringed and that's fine.
You cringed and that's because you read it.
Yeah.
You are the cringe.
Yes.
Yes.
If you're cringing,
it's only the reader's thoughts that matter.
But that's the point of it, as we're talking on the podcast, that's a daunting thing of going and doing 5 minutes of stand up. Your goal is be funny. Being told to go and be funny is a lot more, I think, difficult. I gave you 5 minutes. All right, Rich, make the audience laugh right now. Don't say absurd things. Okay, because you could do it. No, don't.
Okay.
Hold back. Hold your tongue. You look so prepared. But you get...
I was just about to make a bunch of Italians angry at me, and everyone else in the room would be laughing.
Well, nobody in the room, but everybody there would be.
I would be laughing, and I'm everyone. That matters right now in that moment, but that's fine.
But a lot of talking like this is, hey, we're in situational. It's bouncing off your friend, or it's doing things that are more natural. But again, it's hard to just go, hey, be funny. Or again, a lot of books is, hey, be scary. That's what you're asking of the horror paranormal. So I guess it's just more of a, if you miss on the horror element or if you miss on something, often you could recover or you could... There's more grace or the atmosphere. It's not a specific punchline or a specific moment. Comedy is often very micro where, hey, there's some sort of punchline or something there to where that either works or it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, where other feelings you're trying to provoke are set up and brought. It's just comedy's more micro, I guess is what I'm getting at.
The thing is that the difference between a comedy and say horror, like for horror there are like horrific moments. There are the jump scares, but there's also just the tone can be scary. With comedy, there is a punchline. Like ultimately, in some form or another, there's a punchline that will land or not.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you write it wrong, it doesn't land. There is no like kind, I guess there is kind of funny, but kind of funny is more pathetic than actual funny.
Right. Like a nose.
Yeah. If you're just constantly going, ah, that's supposed to be funny. That's very different.
Also, that's the thing, too. A reader can often way more pick up on if the author's trying to be funny or, hey, this scene's supposed to make me laugh. So it's way easier to go, this was either a success or fail. You can pinpoint and go, hey, it's very clear this was a joke, whatever, and then success or fail. That's the comedy element. Now, our next one, our 10th one that we have here for subgenres is grimdark fantasy. Do you want to take this one away?
Sure. Grimdark fantasy is generally surrounded by gritty realism, moral ambiguity, dark, brutal tones, all that idea. To me, I would put grimdark into, there's two type of camps. There's either grimdark setting, like many of these genres, but there's a grimdark setting, and then there's a grimdark theme.
Okay.
So there, I think a lot of the books that I read that I quite like, more often than not, is I like grimdark settings. I'm not the particular fan of grimdark tones, of where where the moral of the story, the message, or the ultimate takeaway from the story is mankind sucks and we're all terrible, and then that's it, and there's no point. There's no point to it all. That is typically set around for grimdark, where all your characters, no one's good. It's just people with power and what they're able to do. But then the setting could just be more grim of, you know, a lot of death, maiming, other brutal things.
Malazan is probably a good example.
Yeah. Malazan has a grim, dark-ish set fantasy setting. But ultimately, when you break it down, it doesn't have a very grim, dark tone. It has a message that is far more about hope, purpose, friendship, things like that.
Whereas First Law is your grimdark tone. It has the messages there. These are grimdark characters, and it features those. A feature of grimdark is characters who are not completely morally sound. They're morally gray, or they're even straight up more villainous, yet sometimes you can reap for them. In some cases with First Law, that there's some connection you make to where
Either charming.
You like following them. But then there's also your Prince of Thorns, which you've read the chapter one of, but in that book where it's just a character who's not rootable, but it's grim dark in the sense of I'm following a bad person. And often the moral of the story or the themes that are explored is, again, more gritty and looking at possibly existentialism in a way, or more nihilism. Those two terms get thrown around a lot when it comes to grim dark, because essentially, are things subjective, and is there a real good and evil? Mm-hmm. That's some things it can explore as well.
Grimdark is a great example that I think it shows a important character element that is important in other genres, but is vitally important in Grimdark. A big reason why we follow a character and we're invested in a character. You may think, oh, we want the character to be rootable. What does that mean? We want a character to be charismatic. Okay, sure, there's elements to it. But ultimately, the most important reason why we follow a character, why we're invested in a character, why we want to see them, more of them, is we follow competency. We like seeing when a character is competent or becomes competent, taking an element that, like, hey, they're not competent at these things, but they have something about them that they apply and you can see them succeed. And so with Grimdark, that's the important factor. They're not morally good, but they have this talent. They have something that they're good at, and they're putting it to use. And that's really enjoyable to follow. Sci-fi stories do this, so it doesn't always have to be like grim or anything, but you know, Mark Watney in The Martian is competent, and it's so enjoyable to follow him, and his competency is important. I'm thinking of another, I saw the trailer and Tim I had the other day of How to Train Your Dragon, of Hiccup, is incompetent at many things. But what's fun to follow him, it's not that he's rootable of like, he's quirky. That's not why we like him. We like him because he's competent. He's smart. He's able to put things together, and seeing him put puzzle pieces together and using his knowledge to make progress is enjoyable. And so I think that's a key to Grimdark, is if you make these characters, you better make them competent. And readers will forgive the moral grayness of them.
What about some of your examples, like Mort from Mort or Shadow from American Gods, where is it competency? Is that a thing that Grimdark needs? Or is it, do you always have to be competent to be rootable in that way? Or interesting, because I guess your competency is a great thing to read at times, but is it a generalized rule, or is it at all should be competent? Or are those examples you agree with of Mort and Shadow?
I think the rule doesn't, like, exceptions do not break the rule. Mort is incredibly incompetent. That's what kind of makes him unique.
So the incompetence is what makes him interesting.
It's a little odd, but then by the end, he does become competent. Like, it's kind of his journey of it. But for the most part, what we follow in a character is competency, not necessarily moral goodness or, righteousness is justice of it. We value competency as humans, and that's what we follow. And I think it's most important in Grimdark.
Would Shadow be an exception?
He's a mysterious... he's mysteriously competent. Like, bring him through several different situations. He somehow, for some reason, is competent. He's somehow getting through things. And his unique neutrality of the world is somehow useful. I think it's more the mystery. But yeah, it certainly is an exception, because a big reason why I was reading that book was not because of Shadow. Like, I wasn't interested in Shadow. I was interested in everything around him.
He was just a shadow.
Yeah. I mean, same thing with Mort. He grew on me, but I wasn't... Like, if the book Mort was only about Mort, how interested would you be?
Well, it is about Mort and death. Yeah.
But, I mean, you got to be honest. You're following kind of like the death and Mort dynamic is far more interesting than Mort alone. It's, you're following
dynamics,
like,
yeah, dynamics, sorry.
Mort is incompetent and death, and I'm waiting to see how this will play out. But I'm not interested necessarily just in Mort.
Because
like Mort himself is not that interesting for a good chunk of the book. It's death that's drawing you in. At least that's how I see it.
I see what you mean. I think, here's something too. Mort to you then got more interesting the more competent he got. Is that what it is? So it's, you like a character with action that's doing something. And Grimdark for you is, even if they have morally gray decisions they're making or are bad people, you like to see somebody that's good at something, and that makes them interesting.
Being good at something and something then applying that to the current situation, even especially if it's unorthodox, is entertaining. It's an attractive thing to read.
Got it.
I mean, why we follow Darrow. He's competent. He's competent at certain things, and he's able to apply it in certain ways.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a universal truth.
I think competency is one value of a character, but I think we already have the answer to, I think the catch-all rule of what makes a character interesting, like bar none, no exceptions, is our rating system, where we have our 5-star is the character irreplaceable. And I think that also covers your Shadow and your Mort and these other characters, that why Mort's interesting, why Shadow's interesting, is they fit the story perfectly, and they're also irreplaceable enough to where you understand how that character functions. Because you could have a comedic character who's incompetent. A lot of comedies are, look at this, you have your straight man and your incompetent character. Like, every comedian sidekick, in a way, is their incompetency is a feature, not a flaw, in that kind of way.
Well, that's
just
the thing.
a different kind of,
if you notice with interest. A lot of comedies, the incompetent character somehow will generally win in the end. Especially their main character, they're supposedly incompetent, and yet they apply their stupidity and actually they use that to their advantage in the end. I mean, that's a ton of comedies of, like, everyone thinks they're dumb. And they are, but their unique view of the world is what saves the day.
Their stupidity saves them in a way.
Yeah. But it's the unique way they view the world instead.
Yeah. And so I think for Grimdark, that's something that could be true where, again, you're reading this gritty character who is a torturer. And that is something. Also, why is he fixated on torturing? What makes that so interesting? I think that's a rule for maybe all of Joe Abercrombie's characters seem to have that in some way. A lot of our main point of views, at least in the first trilogy, all are highly competent grim characters.
With notable exceptions in certain cases. But other cases, it's normally the absence of it is notable. And you follow it for a slightly different reason. It's an exception, but I don't think it breaks the rule.
Oh, so what is your rule? Like, what is the rule you're coming up with here? That interesting characters must be competent? Or what is the Richard rule of competency?
The chief reason why we want to follow a character is competency.
Okay. Yeah, I think I disagree. But I agree it's a feature. It's something in there. I think our rating system answers the question. Is that character irreplaceable? It's a catch-all term. It's a Pokemon. It's got the ball.
Thing is, sure, it covers it all, but it's also very general. And like you ask, why are they irreplaceable? For most of the reason of a story, like why are we following this character? It's because either the world doesn't recognize how they're competent in some way, or it's not conventional.
Yeah.
But their competency is what is attractive to us. And like we see how they either approach a problem in a traditional way or an untraditional way, but either way is still, they're competent. That's why they're in the story.
I mean, the opposite of that would be George Orr in The Lathe of Heaven, which is that character's literally whole point is that he's water.
Yeah.
He's you know, not even a character in a sense. George Orr then won't spoil the ending of what happens, but his character's introduced very much as this is a character who lets anything be done to him, doesn't want to cause any disturbance or make any action, in a sense.
And for most of the, I would say most of the story, he is not the focus and drive of why you read it. You're not following that character well. Of like, you're not attached to that character.
Oh, I wasn't. Yeah, I wasn't for him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Until, I think at the end, what's really interesting is seeing how his unique view of the world was the solution of the story. Of he was incredibly competent at being,
well, don't spoil too much. Yeah, yeah.
But he was competent in some way.
Yeah, but
and it's interesting.
But for me, those where it breaks is I was immediately interested in Shadow, or immediately interested in Mort, and their incompetency, their nothingness was like actually a feature of Shadow. The first line of the book is like Shadow is something. Don't fuck with me enough to be a. He was in a prison. And just his attitude toward life. Like, it's something else gets you interested in the character rather than them being good at something. Of just essentially, here's the thing, too. Of a lot of story arcs, you start as a farm boy or you're not competent. And it's the getting competency. It's growing in your character can be a cool thing.
But what's normally fun with those farm boys is they generally are not incompetent at everything. What's fun is seeing them be competent at something that seems irrelevant and how they use that to then grow and using an unorthodox way to like grow and show of like, oh, wow, they're really competent. I mean, isn't that the whole it's kind of cheesy, but the Karate Kid stuff of, you know, putting, you know, wax on, wax off and going like, oh, he's really good at waxing the car and all that. And like, oh, that's not actually kung fu. And then then you go, ah, look at that. His like, he's really competent at this. And it actually is useful.
The payoff.
It's payoff.
You promise something, you paid off the, cool.
Yes.
That scene wasn't a waste of time. Yeah.
I think that's the same thing with a lot of the characters.
But I think that's more to do with like expectation. That's more to do with promise payoff of, I watched a scene of him waxing stuff for 5 minutes. And then at the end, when you see him doing that, you're going, oh, and connecting the dots and being satisfied in that way. But that's a great example to use for Karate Kid, your classic. That's how, it's just a solid story. I mean, just beat for beat. Miyagi's your mentor character.
Yeah, he is the mentor character.
Yes. I'd even put him above Yoda.
I would. Yeah, of course you would.
Yeah.
Yoda's fine, but I've had enough of the little green man.
Baby Yoda's been pissing you off lately.
He has. Nah, I can't say that with a straight face. Baby Yoda's cute.
Very cute.
I can't stay mad at that face.
Now
even after 3-4 seasons.
we have that opposite of Grimdark now for this 11th subgenre is Noble Bright. It's also, so here's, there's 3 different names for it, and people will argue over this because there's not been a defined name that people have agreed upon yet. It's either called Noble Bright, Grim Heart, or Hope Punk. One of these. But you'll often hear,
I like Noble Bright.
Noble Bright.
I like that one.
Noble Bright's nice.
Which one is your favorite?
I do. That's why I put it first in order. I like that the best. But also Grim Heart is cool just because it's Grim Dark, Grim Heart. However, then, it's almost
Grim
too on the nose.
Doesn't, yeah. Well, Grim Heart. That doesn't
particularly
make sense.
So Noble Bright, I agree with you.
Because Grim is its own word.
Should be sad. Ooh, Grim.
Yeah, yeah, it's Grim. So Grim Heart would be, you know, soulfully sad? I don't like that word. Continue. Sorry about that.
So this is the uplifting counterpoint to Grimdark, where Grimdark focuses on cruel, cynical world for moral ambiguity. Noble Bright fantasy emphasizes hope, heroism, and the idea that good is worth fighting for. Obviously, your Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
And now, would in 1950s, would this be called Noble Bright? No, the word didn't exist. But these kind of heroic, hopeful stories, Mistborn is another one too. Your Noble Bright is that there is meaning. There is something to fight for. It's the world isn't so grim and existential. Look at this, happiness.
Yep.
Yes, that is your Noble Bright.
Your Wheel of Times as well. Yeah. So yeah, a lot of your epic fantasies will be Noble Bright.
Yeah.
I mean, you have Game of Thrones as your example of epic fantasy that is generally considered grimdark, but I don't know exactly how true that would be, but we'll go. I'm only one book in, so we'll see, but I wouldn't necessarily say book one is grimdark.
It has those morally gray characters that you'd associated with it. So,
but it also has your morally righteous characters.
The Starks. Like,
there are heroes and villains in book one.
Very clear who's who as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that Noble Bright, as a lot of the epic fantasy stories that we love, what makes a great Noble Bright story? And then how do you fail at doing Noble Bright? How do you fail at doing Grimheart?
How do you fail at doing Grimheart stuff? Well, calling it Grimheart would be a great start.
That's the first way to fail. Yeah.
I mean, it's the... I mean, trying to make it not cheesy, really? Because how many times the power of friendship, if you have to utter that phrase or you do skirt around any way around it, it's going to just be cheesy and not feel as heartfelt. So there's the surface level of what... you know, a noble, bright story would be.
Yeah.
Of like, you know, the good guys win the end, the power of friendship triumphs over all, and ultimately good conquers evil. You could have that happen, but ultimately not get to the root of it, of challenging a character and showing them the other side, showing them that they're capable of darkness, and then showing them that despite their capability of darkness, despite all the reasons they should or could fall to the dark, that ultimately the right path is in the light, and that hope and friendship is the right solution to a grim question.
That exactly. What
you have anything more?
No, that's it.
Did I just answer it for you?
Yeah.
I took all your words?
No, I asked a question. I'm glad you answered the question. Actually, usually when I ask questions, you just go, by the way, and then go into a thing about
something else.
So I was glad.
Normally just Italians and how they have not mastered the pasta.
Romanticy is the next one. This is your favorite subgenre of them all. Romanticy, it's a blend of romance and fantasy. It often gets a little titillating as well. Why did I do that? It gets titillating as well. Yeah. Romanticy are...
more with the hands. It's
I'm putting my hands down. So the romantic relationship's central point of the story, and it's in a fantasy setting where there's also a world being built, and the world is a feature. There's often dragons and sex and forths and wings, and your romanticy books that are big that we've read. We've read ACOTAR. We've read Fourth Wing.
Yeah, basically.
That's our two romanticy books we've read.
And
two
so
big
we're
ones.
Really experts.
Yes.
At this point.
Well, how do you do it right and wrong? Now, I think we are the wrong ones to ask this question, though.
If you want the actual answer to that question, go to Chris and Mad's channel.
Or Fantasy Fangirls.
Or Fantasy Fangirls.
We did a collab with them on Fourth Wing.
Yep. They know what they're talking about with romanticy.
Yes.
I'll be honest. I don't know how to answer this one. How do you do it right?
I think
I haven't read it right yet. So I only know how they do it wrong.
Well, obviously you have to, in a romanticy book, present two characters that you are rooting for to get together, or some type of dynamic. Could be a love triangle. You often see these tropes in romance books, and often you'll see an enemies to lovers. That's also a typical thing that you'll see.
You want to talk about advantages of romanticism.
Yeah, what are the advantages?
That, I think, is the biggest advantage, is if you're in a standard fiction story, the enemies to lovers trope, especially if it's modern day, like how much of an enemy can you really have in our modern society? Of like, sure, they're your rival at work, or someone who has, I don't know, maybe they're the banker that foreclosed on your father's flower shop business and ultimately, you know, is the one that broke your father's heart and his store and all this, and he's your enemy. But
that's not so specific.
I don't know. It's the Hallmark channel somewhere in here.
I'm just saying, was that personal experience? Like, what happened to your poor...
But other than that, like, you don't get... The nice thing about fantasy is, instead of kind of a soft, like, oh yeah, they're an antagonist in our modern soft society, you have, no, they've literally slaughtered my family, or they're on the opposite side of this medieval war, and there are dragons, and there's the real threat of death and danger. That's an enemy.
That is hot.
That's
what
also hot.
It's sweaty. So when you're seeing that, you see big ol' Zayden.
Oh, you're big old Zayden.
He's got the dragon. He's got that dragon. And that is something that you kind of want to see. Okay, here's another thing we've talked about in our Fourth Wing and ACOTAR episodes, but often the love interest is the typically 99% of the time female protagonist is going around in the story and doesn't want somebody who's standing in front of them and protecting them and being like treating them like a child. You want somebody that trusts that you are capable. You are able to accomplish things. You are able to fight for yourself, but will stand beside you and is there as your...
Basically,
they're there side by side. They're not there...
In the moment you want it, without saying anything, will step in and protect you. But when you don't want them to step in and protect you, they somehow also know when to stand aside and let you take care of yourself, all while reading your mind. That's important.
Now, romanticy, to get it successful, to successfully do romanticy, yeah, that's pretty much it.
God, I did not have a fun time with Fourth Wing. That was a really bad
I had a more
time.
Fun time with Fourth Wing than ACOTAR. I'd put Fourth Wing above ACOTAR.
I guess you're right. I had a worse time with the second ACOTAR book.
I know that was the worst of the three.
Because
the second ACOTAR book is
what's sadder about that one is it's just a little. It is a better written book,
which like, makes
it
worse.
I get it. When everyone's like, "Hey, you got to read book two, A Court of Mist
and Fury."
Yep. It's a better book. Yes, technically it is. It's a better written book. There are more. Like interesting character motivations, all the things I complained about in book one were technically addressed. And you know what? I liked it less for it. I had less fun because it was technically more competent and a lot more boring. We're not the right people to talk about romanticism.
We're not, but I think, is it bad that we've read those two and I'm going, I think I know how all of them are written.
I think I got it. I think I got a finger on the pulse.
The best romanticy book out there. Actually, here's a romanticy book that's the best. The Sword of Kygan.
I don't know if that could count.
It's not exactly romanticy.
It's not.
I'm stretching it, but...
Yeah.
That's what I... I'm just saying...
It's a fantasy.
With romance.
And then features the dynamics of a romance.
There's romance involved. However, what?
Honestly, it's not even romance.
No, no. mute this. Not with.
It's a lie. Yeah, we're just lying. It's not romance, but well, it's fine.
Okay, I don't want to get because the book's so goated. Book's so amazing. Go read it. But the that's the thing with romanticy as well. It's not just hey, there's romance in fantasy. That's different. It's just a lot of fantasy has romance. Romanticy has to be this relationship and this dynamic is the core feature, and you often see those things associated with some titillating stuff and some sort of element of. Well, obviously, you have to have fantasy in it as well. So usually with your ACOTAR and Fourth Wing, they are high fantasy books where it's completely new in different worlds. I often notice as well it's focused on some sort of specific fantasy element. So Fourth Wing is dragons. ACOTAR's fairies. I imagine like Twilight is vampires. So I often notice that it's focused on a certain type of fantasy creature or something that another trope, so werewolves, dragons, fairies, take your picking, vampires, and take your pick, and it's usually that type of fantasy thing, and maybe even falling in love with that fantasy creature. That's another aspect of it. And, oh, okay. All that stuff. Now, to finish up this episode, and we have another fantasy subgenre breakdown. This is just a part one, because we don't, wow, we're already taking a lot of your day. So this is the capstone of it all, erotic fantasy. Is the 13th one. And there is a difference, I've been told. There is a difference. Summer, shout out Summer. There's a difference where the erotic fantasy is a subgenre of fantasy where sexuality, desire, and intimate relationships play a central, explicit role in the story. We've not read this book, but Kuschel's Legacy, Kuschel's Dart, that...
Thought it was Kuschel's Dart.
I think Legacy is the series.
Okay.
Dart might be book one. But I don't think I've read a single erotic. So ACOTAR book two, they have sex scenes, but
it's not a central point to the story.
Erotic fantasy, it's their sex.
That's the thing. That's the point of the book.
Having not read them though, people will say, so again, not the people that ask this question necessarily of what are the advantages of fantasy. So I have nothing to say other than have not read an erotic fantasy.
We almost, if we didn't just step in and put down the band hammer.
Oh, God, yeah.
One of the books that was suggested for our monthly book club was...
Yeah, shout out to Salty for that awful...
Wasn't his book, bitch.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
Nope.
Oh, no, he just wanted it to get picked. Who pitched it?
One of our new patron members.
You son of a... I cut you off, though. They say the book title, it was... Was it V?
I believe so. V. Anyway... She suggested the Morning Glory Milking Farm, which is an erotic fantasy book about milking minotaurs. Now, you're asking me, yes, milking the male minotaurs, yes. That's the book. And apparently, it features a critique of late-stage capitalism. Which, to me, sounds like the exact opposite of everything I want to read in a novel. Like, I couldn't pick a you want to ask for, hey, what's Richard's opposite taste in books? That one.
Morning Glory.
Morning Glory Farm. Milking Farm.
It's even more opposite for me because it also has milk and dairy.
Oh, it's even worse.
It is literally the opposite. I get to claim that.
Spoiler alert, it doesn't have milk in it.
Oh, it's the other kind?
Did you not get it?
Oh, shit.
Do you not understand? Like, no, it's not milk.
I thought they were
That's why I said male minotaurs. They're milking the male minotaurs.
Oh, actual minotaur men.
Yes.
We'll see you next episode in our... I'm going to church. You started this episode with a raunchy... We need the Bible.
Oh, but no, that's a book. Oh, God.
I need the Bible now.
Okay. Cool. I know we're judgmental on this podcast.
Really?
But I do want to say, I see someone reading ACOTAR. I'm not judging them.
Oh, no.
See him reading Fourth Wing? I'm not judging. I see you reading Morning Glory Milking Farm in public. I think you should be judged and should be shamed into, keeping that filth at home. Don't read that on the subway.
I don't.
It's not the place.
Now, it's even worse if you're reading that book and you're out in public and have
the fact that that's like just in Barnes Noble, like right there.
Is it?
Yeah.
I've seen it.
Oh. It's
wow.
It's wild. I'm astonished they allow such filth near children. Terrible. It's a great reason. Like, hey, what are reasons why it's a good thing that the literacy rate in the United States is dropping? That would be one. The fact that they can't read that book.
We are saving the children. You realize what you're doing is you're doing the parent thing of you say the thing not to do. Now everyone's going to be like, oh, I gotta read the summer. I gotta pick it up. And you're now enticing everybody to read it more. You're the biggest advocate for it.
And you know what's great about it?
What?
They're going to have a terrible time. What? I'm pushing them to have a terrible time.
One psycho out there is going to be... I'm so glad.
That literally happened to Salty. Literally, he was advocating, like, because we were against it. He was going like, he's voting for it. And then he tried reading it. And he's like, this was terrible. I hated this. I hated every second of it.
And if he hated it,
He's like, ha. I love it. So go ahead. Go ahead, read
because
it.
Because that's Salty's taste.
Be antagonistic.
But Salty's taste is he loves, like, milking farm type book stories and also Dungeon Crawler Carl comedy.
That is true. His favorite book that we ever recommended to him was Dungeon Crawler Carl. It is, if I had to say, it is Salty's book.
I was so shocked he didn't like it.
I was
so surprised. Oh.
I wanted to keep lying.
The meme, yeah. The meme. But it shocked me that he didn't, because when you think Salty,
whatever.
He's wrong about what he thinks. No, not even that it's the best, but.
No, he's wrong that he doesn't like it.
Yeah. That's it.
The fact that he doesn't like it is an incorrect opinion for him.
Don't come to the book club and pitch stuff like Morning Glory, whatever, Milking Farm.
It will be denied. You get to vote, but it's also not a democracy because we get to say no to things.
Also, remember, use our code TUTORAMBLE on display.com. Thank you for sponsoring this episode. And can we even have them sponsor an episode where we talked about Morning Glory, Milking Farm?
No. Display's nice to us, though. I think they'll let it slide.
Use code TUTORAMBLE. We don't know if we'll probably get paid for it, right?
Maybe.
We'll see. Hey, go check that out. Thanks for watching this episode. See our part two, which is coming out. And
next week?
Yeah, next week or
this week.
The next upload will be part two of this. We'll see you soon.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.